Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Come and see the podcast live at the Shibbett Theater in Boston.
The first week of November is going to decide the fate of the nation. I think we speak for all when I say James and I are excited to turn the page, and we want to spend part of that week with you. That's why we're taking Politics War Room live to Boston at the Shibbett Theater on November the 2nd with a special guest, the great historian Doris Goodwin. We're going to really rally the troops, hear from her, and kick off election week by pre-partying with our listeners with a live show. It's going to be a blast. James, I mean, Boston right before an election doesn't get any better than that.
It doesn't get any better than that. And it doesn't get any better than Doris. The ultimate guest, you know, politically, historically, personality, sports, you name it. I mean, Doris is truly one of the true great Americans we have. And the fact that we're going to have her in Boston this close to the election, it's going to be a terrific event. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to it. And I love going to Boston, and this is going to be a ton of fun, and let's everybody come together and do this.
Absolutely. We want everyone listening to join us on the tour during the election's final stretch. All you have to do is go to politicon.com/tour and get your tickets for November 2nd at the Shibbett Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. Don't wait. They're going fast, and we want to see as many of you there as we can. So head to politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, Ben Wickler, and tennis legend and political activist Martina Navratilova. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. In addition to the live shows, the documentary, Carville, Winning is Everything, Stupid, comes out on October 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern on CNN. For updates and some great behind-the-scenes content, follow James on Twitter at James Carville and on his new TikTok, James on TikTok, at Real James Carville. Then get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com and tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Glean, 3-Day Blinds, and Beam. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, we're looking at another battleground state this week, Wisconsin. We have Democratic State Chair Ben Wickler, one of our all-time favorite guests. There's no better state chair in America. Ben, this morning I looked at 10 polls in the last 2.5 weeks, Wisconsin polls. Harris is up by an average of 1. That shows you how tight it is. But both in 16 and 20, Trump outperformed his polls. Are you worried that may happen again this time?
It's my job to be worried about everything. So yes, I'm definitely worried about that. I will say that there's reasons to think it may not happen the same way this time. One of the big things is that Wisconsin has same-day voter registration. And in 2020, the Democrats had registered early. And so they cast their ballots with absentee ballots. And the people who same-day registered, who'd never been polled, were overwhelmingly Republican. This time, same-day registration benefits both sides equally. The doors open to both. There's not this huge wave of early absentee voting on our side. It's up from 2016, but it is not the same kind of wholesale shift in how people vote. So we have we're trying to expand the pool on our side. Republicans are trying to expand it on their side. Our ground game is better than theirs. I think that this is every kind of metric that I can look at says this is another incredibly close race. But absolutely, I stay up at night wondering if there's going to be a wave of Republican voters coming out of the woodwork, and we have to try to overshoot our mark. I don't want to be content to say that we're going to win by half a point. I'd rather have a margin of potential victory so that if there is even more of a Republican wave than we anticipate, that we're ready to handle it.
Well, last time Biden ran up big margins in Dane, Madison, and in Milwaukee. I think he won both by over 180,000 votes. Can you replicate that this time?
I think we can, but I also think there's other pieces of the equation that we have to attend to. So one of the huge questions is what happens in rural Wisconsin. We have a ton of rural and small town voters in Wisconsin. You know, more than half the electorate lives in communities of less than 15,000 people. And so you have to show up in small towns and water tower towns in a big way. We do better in elections in small towns and rural parts of our state than Democrats do nationally. I think we overperform in every single county, but showing up, you know, massively there to hold down margins and try to gain a point or two, it really matters. And the other piece is the kind of suburbs, especially of Milwaukee, but also of places like La Crosse, Eau Claire, Green Bay, those are red. But if we can swing them a little bit more towards pink, that helps a lot too. And, you know, the Republican strategy is kind of the reverse plus voter suppression. They want to stop people from voting and not just try to persuade people. So we have to fight that as well. But you have to use an all-of-the-above strategy in Wisconsin because the margins come down to less than one percentage point most of the time.
We want to get to all those. Let me ask you as an aside, what you thought of the Walls-Vance debate earlier this week, and does Tim Walz help you much in those rural areas?
Walz helps a ton for three reasons. One is he's great in general. The second is he's on local TV all the time as governor of Minnesota in western Wisconsin. So you have about 400,000 Wisconsinites who, when they turn on the local news, they cover Walz just as much as they cover Evers because their viewership is on both sides of the Mississippi. So that group of folks knows him like they know their own governor, and he is a household name already. And the third reason is in lots of parts of Wisconsin, people say to me, they say to each other, he's like my dad, or he's like the dad I want to be. He's a familiar kind of guy, talking about Menards, the way he tracks football, understanding how to work his car. Like, he is somebody who is the kind of good neighbor that you want to dig you out of a snowstorm. And he demonstrates, you know, Harris choosing him demonstrates that this is a ticket that is comfortable and familiar in the small towns across Wisconsin that make up most of the electorate. So it really helps to have him there. And in that debate, what you saw was, you know, very slick, total lies from J.D. Vance. And in a way, some of the lies were so obvious that they actually annoyed people who don't pay much attention to politics. And you saw a Walz who is not particularly polished, but who nailed it on things that really matter to people, including, you know, who won the last election, but also on the economy, also on questions around abortion and how people can lose their lives in Trump abortion bans. And Vance, and healthcare was one that jumped out at me and punched me in the face. Vance saying that Trump was the guy who fixed the Affordable Care Act, we all know, because we all remember, everyone who loves someone or has a pre-existing condition, we all remember exactly who was trying to take away those protections. And it was not, Trump was not the champion. He was the threat. So this is a moment where, the substance actually, and we saw this in the polls with undecided and independent voters, the substance actually trumped the style here. And, yeah, I don't think this moved the needle in a big way in either direction, but I'd much rather be asked than them on the other side of that vice presidential.
Well, one final question, and I'll turn it over to James, and that is, we mentioned Milwaukee in passing. The black vote hasn't really turned out as well as a lot of people hope, not just in Milwaukee, but Philadelphia, Detroit, and elsewhere. Why will it be any different this time?
The particular thing in Wisconsin is that we have a really, really restrictive voter ID, voter suppression law that was written in order to push down votes among black Wisconsinites. There was a whistleblower who was a Republican staffer at the time who said that when Republicans were briefed on the effect on black voters, they were giddy and frothing at the mouth. And that law went into effect in 2015. And the effect has been exactly as intended. In 16, 18, 20, 22, we're the only battleground where African-American turnout was lower in 18 than it was in 14. And that means that we're kind of sprinting to stay in place on a treadmill, because younger black voters, and same across races, are less likely to have driver's licenses. And so, you know, less than half of Black Wisconsinites in the most recent data I've seen have driver's licenses in our state. So there's a ton that we do as a party. We're investing intensively. There are allied groups that are doing intensive investments. We have a combination of organizing, friend to friend, neighbor to neighbor, phone calls, visibility, local events. We have surrogates coming in all the time. We're doing stuff on Black media, on Black radio. And there are amazing Black leaders in Milwaukee, both elected leaders like the mayor and county executive and president of the county board and who are doing this work and from grassroots organizations who are doing amazing work. And all of that, it means that we're shooting to push things up, but it's not going to be the kind of breakthrough, blow out the top turnout that we had in 2012 or 2008 or 2004. We're talking, you know, in the thousands of votes, not the many tens or hundreds of thousands of votes here. So all of that matters in Wisconsin. We're the state where, you know, Biden won by 20,682. But we're working at the margin in a really voter hostile situation. And the voters who succeed in casting a ballot for the first time or who come back despite Republican voter suppression attempts, they're heroes of a democracy, and we are here to support them all the way through.
James.
So Ben, you said something that caught attention. You said we have a better ground game than they do. Do they have any ground game? I'm serious. Is there any concerted Trump field organization, GOTV, door knocking? I don't know, whatever, you know, literature, signs, anything like that.
You're asking a very perceptive question. They've kind of collapsed on this thing, and it's stunning to see. So they have outsourced field organizing to Elon Musk's Super PAC and to Turning Point USA. And those organizations have hired vendors that supposedly do door knocking on their behalf with paid, people going out and knocking on doors. And everything I'm hearing, you know, secondhand through Republican operatives is that people they've hired are people who fudge the numbers. We are doing hundreds of thousands of voter contacts a week through our ground game operation. On the Republican side, they're sending out tons of paid mail, paid for through the Republican Party of Wisconsin. But I've only heard of two voters who've actually seen literature put in place by those Republican super PACs. And there's grumbling about it at the grassroots level. Their signage game is like really out of whack, which it used to be that rural Wisconsin was a sea of Trump signs in 2016. We were able to meet them in 2020. I think we're going to outsign them this time. Normally, you know, in Wisconsin, there's all these places where Democratic volunteers will be walking down the street one way and Republican volunteers will be walking down the street the other way, and they have to decide whether to shake hands or make eye contact or, you know, how to handle each other. That's just not happening right now. And that, if this race does come down to a hairline in the polling, we can outwork the other side and win the election. And that, my dream is to win by more than one percentage point, because that way we don't have a recount and the lawsuits and all that stuff. But, you know, if this is a half a point race, the fact that their ground game has been, essentially handed off to grifters, and ours is the result of a multi-year neighborhood-based massive organizing push, that could be the ballgame in the state that could tip the whole country.
Okay, so I'm just getting this. There's only opinion. There's no way to quantify this. How much do you think having a superior ground game, is it good for a percent, a half percent, a percent and a half? And I know it's impossible to quantify, but you've been doing this for a long time. You got a lot of time and money invested in establishing this. Are you confident there's a payoff in this?
I am. I think it's in the range of a point. Like, you know, if it is really strong, it can get, and the other side is not, then that can get you a net point. I think, which,
a lot.
You know,
there's some people know. In this business, that's a lot.
For the last six presidential races here, that's more than the margin.
In Wisconsin, it's more than a lot.
Yeah. If the others, you know, in 2020, the Republicans ran a serious field operation here. They announced, but also we had evidence to believe, they knocked on 2 million doors in Wisconsin. And they hired their state director in July of 2019. So they ran a whole operation. And on our side, we were virtual, so we didn't knock on doors. And I think that cost us. I think that's one reason why the polls were so off, is that the other side was present in person and we were restricted to just virtual activities. We had a massive COVID outbreak in the fall of 2020 because Republicans sued and got all the COVID mitigation measures knocked out. But this time, it's like they're not doing the virtual thing either. So we have the organizing edge in a significant way. And we're just pulling out all the stops to ramp that up, because that is one of the things that we can actually control, is like how much we're able to get folks out talking to the voters who need to hear from people, and especially friend-to-friend organizing, which we have a much more sophisticated operation. We can give volunteers an app that lets them see which of their friends is registered to vote, who's requested an absentee ballot, who's already early voted, and then they can reach out to the folks who still need to vote. And that puts power into the hands of every volunteer.
So let's assume we have listeners here and they like this idea and they want to financially support it. Where do they send the check and who is the payee?
This is one of my favorite questions. So
yeah, I think it would be.
You can...
a good one, too.
We can go to, yeah. And let me be clear. When the Republicans were in charge, they eliminated the limit on donations to state parties in Wisconsin. So a listener who's worried that they might hit some kind of limit, worry not. You can add as many zeros as you want.
All right.
In Wisconsin, you can go to
WISDEM. Sky's the ceiling.
Sky's the ceiling. Your bank account's the ceiling. Your credit card limit's the ceiling. So you go to wisdems.org/donate and you can contribute online, or you can write a check to Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And you can find the address on the website, but I'll say it here too. It's 1686, a P.O. Box 1686, Madison, Wisconsin 53703. And we will put those dollars to work. We are literally in daily reviews figuring out what we have the resources to add. Because this last push in the sprint with a race this close, it's going to determine the outcome of this election.
So let's assume that we have some motivated people listening to this and they want to come to Wisconsin and help and they get there a week early. Can you put them to work? Is there something that they can do? So if they just go and say, I want to volunteer, you can deploy them.
We have 50 offices around the state, and we have a couple hundred more like coffee shops and living rooms that we use for campus launch locations. Wherever you might come, we can put you to work. And some places in our state, we can put you to work to help elect the president of the United States, the Senate race, which has gotten really close because we're up against this massive self-funding banker named Eric Hovde. He's from California, and the Republicans just dumped $17 million into super PAC ads to help him. That race in the most recent poll, we're only up by 2. So that race is getting really intense for Tammy Baldwin. And then we got House races we're trying to flip, including the 1st, the 3rd, and the 8th congressional districts. And then we have fair maps in our state legislature, finally, because we defeated the gerrymander. So we have a shot to go from 35 out of 99 seats in our state assembly to winning the majority this year if we can pull this off and breaking the state Senate supermajority. And that means that there are parts of Wisconsin where you can work on 4 toss-up races simultaneously when you turn out voters. That is some of the highest impact time that anyone can spend. And that is one reason we are thrilled to welcome people to come here. And also, if you go to wisdems.org/volunteer, you can join a virtual phone bank, which we have going pretty much every day. And you can call voters in Wisconsin. You can call door-knocking volunteers and can remind them about their shifts. You can help with our voter protection efforts to chase down absentee ballots. We will put you to work wherever you might be if you can give us your time and your talent.
Okay, I'm talking about here. I was one observation. If we could just clone Ben Wicklund and get him in the other 49 fucking states, we might go 40 and 10 in this election. But anyway,
there is no one better, James.
No, we're in total agreement.
Ben, let me ask you this: you're both a manufacturing and a farming state. How do Trump's tariffs proposals play in Wisconsin?
So Trump is planning to just jack up prices for everybody. And the other thing about tariffs, it's not like other countries just get hit by a tariff and say, all right, whatever. They impose tariffs back, which means that we get into a trade war. And Wisconsin farmers, you know, we export a lot of ginseng to China. We're the biggest manufacturers of manhole covers in the world. And that stuff is all going to get hit by counter tariffs from other countries. So if Trump goes through with this plan, it has a huge effect on all the people that make things in Wisconsin, and we're having a manufacturing renaissance here right now, and all the people who buy things in Wisconsin, which is everybody. The idea of putting a $4,000 tax on everyone who buys, you know, food and clothing or anything that involves any kind of imports, it is insulting and infuriating. And I think the thing about, you can see in polls, trust for Harris versus Trump on the economy, that gap is closing rapidly. And I know, James, you've been a real advocate on this. Trump is trying to kill a boom, including a manufacturing boom that is underway. And we got lots more to do to bring down costs and support, you know, unionization of jobs, and all this kind of stuff. But Trump is trying to take away that something people have that they are counting on by putting his terrible policies in place. And we want to make sure that people understand exactly what's at stake in that fight.
Ben, you alluded a minute ago to the state legislative races. You've had the most gerrymandered map probably in America. You now have a new map this year. Can you win the state house?
So this is, it's a very intense fight. Like so much in Wisconsin, it comes down to less than one percentage point. If we win exactly the same vote distribution as Biden won in 2020, then we will fall one seat short of the majority. We'll get 49 out of the 99 seats. Then there are three seats that are within the next half a point. So if we can do like a point better than Biden did, we could win, you know, 50, even 51, 52 seats. Now that depends on making sure the people who vote for president also vote for state legislature, and that we're doing a ton of work to make sure that that happens. But this is a jump ball. And I was talking to an analyst yesterday who's like, I think you're going to fall just short. And we're going to do everything in our power to cross that last line, which will potentially be a few hundred votes across a couple districts that'll determine whether Robin Voss, who's been a cancerous presence in Wisconsin politics, whether he stays as Speaker of our state assembly or whether he's defeated and Greta Neubauer, who would be the youngest and just an extraordinarily dynamic and amazing leader, takes the helm in the state assembly, leads on drafting the state budget, does the stuff that the Wisconsinites have been crying out for, from healthcare to protections on abortion to funding public schools. That is all in the balance in a tiny number of districts with a tiny number of votes.
Ben, you've mentioned how important really everything is. It's not just Dane and Milwaukee, but it's all those rural counties and the suburbs there. I remember several times when I've said, what should I look for? You said, watch Sauk County. It's a fairly rural place in southern Wisconsin. And I looked, and I think Biden carried it by 615 votes. Trump carried it by 109 votes in 2016. Why is Sauk County such a bellwether? And how's it looking this time, Ben?
So Sauk County is one of only two counties that was, Obama. I think it was Obama, Walker, Trump, Evers, and Baldwin in 18, and then Biden. And then it went again for Evers in 2022. Sauk County has this mix of some rural areas, of some small, medium-sized towns, places like Baraboo, and then some kind of, spillover from Madison, and people get Madison local TV and drive to work there. So it actually incorporates the small towns, the rural areas, and the suburbs that, across the state make up the whole thing. It's a little fractal of the whole state. And in this election, like, it is one of the most contested places, as you would expect. The modeling says that it is a toss-up right now. And the question that we have to answer is whether that toss-up lands on our side. It's like 3% of the total votes in the state, but what happens there is probably going to mirror what happens across the state of Wisconsin. And in Sauk County and everywhere else, we're doing everything we can to pull out all the stops and win.
Well, if anybody can do it, it's Ben Wickler. James?
I want to go back to the tariffs, because we focus on agriculture, and we should. And we export a lot of dairy products, obviously, a lot of things. But this guy says manufacturing. I think, do you still make motorcycles there?
Yeah, Harley Davidson's.
Yeah, and don't you make a few plumbing fixtures are made in
Kohler? You know my state. Yes, okay. You're speaking my language here.
But these
beer too
are big. Tariffs would kill these two businesses.
You
putting tariffs on. They start putting tariffs on Harley Davidson. Next thing you know, you're buying Yamahas and BMW. I mean, they're not the only people operating in the motorcycle space, hardly.
Yeah, not just that. We've seen this before. Because when Trump put his, launched his trade wars, then people put targeted tariffs on motorcycles coming out of Wisconsin, because they knew that would hurt Trump politically. We have seen this exact movie. And Trump was actually a huge problem for Wisconsin. We lost a ton of small farms. We lost manufacturing jobs. Because of his reckless trade wars when he was in office. And sometimes a strategic tariff here or there in these fights, it can make sense. We've seen that from the Biden administration. There's room for that as part of an overall strategy. But just putting a tariff on everything in order to piss off the rest of the world and expect them to not punch back, and also just to drive up the cost for American consumers, it's an inflation bomb. That's what 16 Nobel Prize winning economists called it. Voters are telling us that they're mad about prices, and Harris has a plan to bring them down, and Trump has a plan to drive up prices for everybody. and then kill jobs for people that make things that we export. So that is like a 1-2 punch that no amount of tax cuts for billionaires can possibly make up for when it comes to working families in the Badger State. If this election is on the economy and people have a clue about the effects of the policies of the candidates, then we win this thing.
So I don't know if, did you see the clip of Tommy Thompson making a complete obsequious fool out of himself and Trump texting him to get the hell off the stage? Did you see that clip?
I managed to avoid that clip, but it sounds like something I might enjoy in a moment of downtime.
But he always struck me as a kind of chamber of commerce, glad hand, inoffensive. And he was up there just being like an obsequious lapdog to Trump, talking about his grandchildren. And then he says he gets this message and he says Trump said to get the hell off the stage. I can see Lindsey Graham. Okay, I understand. He's the most pliable human being that ever lived. I wouldn't have voted for Tommy Thompson, but that never struck me. I've met him 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
What drives people that kind of behavior?
So I don't think that Tommy Thompson used to win by big margins and used to work to get endorsements from unions. He used to try to find a way to be a majoritarian kind of leader for the state. And he won 4 times. But this is a guy who kind of loves to be loved, and he loves to be loved by Donald Trump. And so he's doing the thing that is, it's just kind of heartbreaking to watch people who have comported themselves with dignity at other moments in their careers, just abasing themselves. And Trump loves that. He loves to break people over his knee.
This guy came to a fork in the road. He could have been Mitt Romney. He could have been Lindsey Graham. Guess what? Hey, Tommy, you're Lindsey Graham now. Okay. Thank you, man. That was one of the best interviews we've had. I mean, that's how we, to people listening, you want to know how to do it. You just heard how to do it. Okay. That's what you just heard. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I'm grateful for the chance to join you, and I'm grateful to everyone in this audience jumping in with both feet. You want to wake up the day after this election feeling like you did everything you could. Can I close with a Vince Lombardi quote?
You may. Absolutely.
This is, I think about this in tough moments. Vince Lombardi, legendary Green Bay Packers coach, a revered figure in my state. He said, I firmly believe, He says, I firmly believe that any man or woman's finest hour, the greatest fulfillment of all that he holds dear, is that moment when he has worked his heart out in a good cause and lies exhausted on the field of battle, victorious. That's the plan. That's who you want to be the day after the election.
November 6th, the morning of November 6th, I expect to see Ben Wickler lying on that field, joyous, victorious, again, I second what James said. You're a fabulous guest, Ben, and we'll talk to you several times before November the 5th. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, while you're waiting to see us live, get the ultimate inside look on the 2024 election by checking out Carville, Winning is Everything, Stupid, a new documentary by Matt Tarnauer on October 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern on CNN. I'm going to tell you, I got a look at it, and it exceeded my very lofty expectations. It really captures James. The film follows James through the current cultural and political landscape. It dives into his unique marriage to Republican strategist Mary Madeline, offering an inside look at how they navigate their bipartisan life. If you're looking for an unfiltered take on the state of politics, the Carville-Madeline dynamic, and the drama of the 2024 election, you won't want to miss this on Saturday, 7 p.m. Eastern on CNN. For updates and some great behind-the-scenes content, follow James on Twitter at James Carville or his new TikTok at Real James Carville. James, I'll bet our listeners are excited for this as I am, and I've seen it, and I'm going to watch it again. You said, go watch it on the big screen, but start Saturday on CNN.
Yeah, well, thank you, and I can happily report to you, I just from the time the show started to now, just been texted 2 boffo reviews. I mean, you don't have to take our word for it. I mean, the reviews that have come in on this have been really extraordinary, and I think Matt did a great job, and I'll just take 1 minute where I think he brought to this film. he was a gopher in the 84 Mondale campaign. He was actually one of the assistants to Susan Estridge in the 88
oh my God.
Dukakis campaign. And he covered politics for Vanity Fair. And, you know, Al, you can appreciate this. If you have a director that understands the business of politics, it really gives you a leg up. If we'd have had a very artistic, very great filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, that didn't understand politics, that hadn't worked at the kind of gopher and more senior level and then covered it at, you know, some of the best political reporting in you know, modern American presidential politics, I just think Matt was able to bring something to this that were very hard to get. And I'm just very pleased by our collaboration with him.
Watch it Saturday night at 7 p.m. on CNN.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, James, one thing we agree on is that this election is close and that Harris probably has a better hand and it's difficult to see her losing. But I've got a number of worries I want you to address. One report is that Harris is running 5 to 10 points below where she should be with Latino voters. That was on MSNBC. CNN, Harry Enten, a good reporter, says she's struggling with union workers. There's a dock strike that prolongs going to take the gloss off a great economy. And the Israeli-launched war in the Middle East certainly doesn't help Democrats. So bring me back before I start walking on that ledge, James.
Well, I think each of the things you say on their own are legitimate observations. Plus, in polling, when you have a 7% undecided, you're not going to automatically match the Biden number. But we do know this on Election Day. There are no undecideds. It has to add up to 100. In terms of the Latino vote, some concerns, but if you remember in 2022, we thought we might lose the Nevada Senate seat because polling had showed we were losing or hemorrhaging or whatever term you want to use, and we did no such thing. I got to tell you, the best issue that I think we have with Latino voters is abortion. Okay, and a lot of really smart people think that saved Catherine's Senate seat in Nevada, and there's probably some legitimacy to that. But you know, we're certainly can do better in terms of the world events. I mean, the president doesn't want to invoke Taft Hartley because he wants to have the unions to have bargaining power. That's understandable. I, from what I know and read, we could take 10 days, a couple weeks, maybe outside 3 weeks of the strike without much damage. But if it goes on and on and on, you know, people are not going to say, well, the port operators are at fault here. They'll just blame whoever's in. So it's something to worry about. The Middle East is, well, it's the Middle East. I thought Walsh was pretty good last night on it. I mean, how much difference it makes. But yeah, you have every right to see things and have concern about them. But, you know, on the upside, if you look at our friend Della Volpe's Harvard Youth Poll, look pretty good. If you look across the whole Poland landscape, when people get frustrated, they call me, how can this goddamn thing be close? Trump is such a pig. It shouldn't be close. You know, it's not election day yet. Let's see where it ends up after all the votes count. Maybe it's not as close as we think. Poland is very, it can do certain things that it can't do other things. And I keep saying this, well, you're up one here, you're down one there. But yeah, it's a lot of statistical noise, I think. But let's wait and let's just remember it adds up to 100 on election day. You're not going to be any undecideds. I think we'll probably end up doing better than we polled. We certainly did in 2022 with Latino voters. Am I nervous? Am I scared? Of course I am. But would I rather be us than them? Yes, I would.
Well, I agree with what you said about polling. However, I am going to cite the Cook Political Report polls that came out today, just because I think they're straight down the middle. And they were interesting of all the battleground states. They had Harris up 1 in Pennsylvania, up 2 in Wisconsin, up 2 in Arizona, up 3 in Michigan, and 1 in Nevada, North Carolina even, and Georgia minus 2. That may be a fairly, and very, very little, very few undecideds in any of those states. I think that may be a, you know, pretty good reflection of where we are. And my guess, James, is that there's two things. There's kind of cross currents. If I'm a Republican, I'm thinking, okay, Trump always outperforms the polls, or has in 16 and 20. So I'm going to hope that's true this time. If I'm a Democrat, I'm going to say, hey, at the end, people, that small group of softer, undecided voters, it may be more like 1980 when they say, what the hell? I think she may be up to it. I don't want him for 4 more years. So, you know, we'll probably be nervous right up to November 5th.
I'm not very good at predicting things. You see, all these races that are like right on the edge, I think they're going to almost all fall one way. And I would take us before them right now. Now, next week, change my mind. I would say, well, you know, I don't feel like I did an October of whatever the day is, 3rd or 2nd.
Right.
So we'll see. But, I mean, that's where I am.
James, let's do a quick thing on the vice presidential debate. I think J.D. Vance actually probably helped himself because he didn't come across like a madman. Tim Walz, after a rocky start, did okay. But like most other VP debates, I don't think it's going to much matter. And whereas I think Vance probably won on points, I think Vance did more enduring damage with some of his comments, like refusing to admit that Trump won in 2020 and making a preposterous claim that Trump was the one that saved Obamacare. I mean, that's just a lie. Walz's stumbles, I think, were less enduring, real, you know, kind of not addressing why he once said he was at Tiananmen and 1989 when he really wasn't. He doesn't answer quite as sharply as he should on Minnesota's abortion law. But I don't think it's going to affect the outcome. But I think those today, too many people in our business, in the press business, are celebrating, you know, a great J.D. Vance comeback. I think that's an exaggeration.
So I'm just going to incorporate this into my outrage because I'm very, like, off the wall with this. So what did Vance say about Trump and Affordable Care? What is the word that he used that, like, Trump?
He saved it, wasn't it?
Right. But that is about a huge issue that has a law that is important to people, all right, that has a large bias that people do think that Democrats are better. That is an out-and-out lie. Okay, let me just say it as plain as I can. It's not close.
Right.
You can't say, well, you make it a no. He did everything he could. Why isn't Harris herself out today talking about that? If you're 2 months off, I spoke to a reporter today and it was, look, you're going to say being 2 months off of where you were in 1989 is the goddamn equivalent of sitting there and looking right at the camera and say Trump saved the Affordable Care Act when, in fact, he did everything in his power to destroy it. And this is not an issue that people don't care about. It's not a nitpicking thing. And I got to tell you, the White House response, and I think by and large, to a large extent, the press response, is not at all measured to the gravity of this lie, of the importance of this, of you're lying about people's goddamn lives, all right? And I'm for the life of me, and I was told that David Axelrod was on TV this morning making so much the same point. What the fuck are y'all doing in the Harris campaign? Get her out there now.
James, I would be tempted. Yeah, I think it's really serious. You ought to do that and go after him. I also would be tempted maybe to run an ad or two copying what you did in New Jersey in 1988 when Pete Dawkins said he came back. The only state he wanted to really go back to and run was New Jersey. And then you had a huge laugh track. I think J.D. Vance saying that Obama saved or
Trump
saved Obamacare and then have a laugh track because it is so preposterous and people know it.
They ought to have Obama and Nancy Pelosi, and they ought to do a Zoom call with the national media. Yeah. I mean, kick the crap out of this now.
Well, you got a picture of John McCain killing his effort to kill.
Right, with the thumbs down, one of the most iconic images in the history of the United States Senate. What the fuck are you people doing? Get off your ass. Move, move, move.
Well, let's hope they have. James, two of America's most memorable athletes died this week. Pete Rose, the all-time leader in hits, and Dikembe Mutombo, a fabulous Hall of Fame basketball player and the NBA's global ambassador. What's your memory or take on Pete Rose?
Well, if you're a Phillies fan, wouldn't he – remember, it was Bob Boone. I forgot, dropped the pop up.
I was at the game.
That might be one of the five greatest baseball plays of all time. Yeah. I mean, every little league coach was like, God damn, we coached this. And, you know, we never get the point across, it actually decides a World Series.
Yeah, I mean, just to basically say, so the catcher, a foul ball, the catcher went to catch. It should have been routine. And the catcher muffed it. He dropped it. And Pete Rose, the first baseman, had come over and caught it.
And that's kind of what you're supposed to do, but very few people do.
Right.
The catcher always catches it. Why do you want me to run all the way from first base, 90 feet, run my ass off, get in position? And Pete Rose did that. That, you can't, 4,100 plus hits. He was as goddamn stupid as he was good. And let me tell you, he was really good. So John Dowd of the Dowd Report, who is not a Democrat at all. I had lunch with him after all of this. And just so you know, they had worked out a deal. They were, the IRS was going to drop all the charges against him. Major League Baseball was going to reinstate him. He was going to be eligible for Hall of Fame, for everything. He could go back to managing. He could do whatever he wanted. If he just said, I bet on baseball. That's all he had to say. And he was too goddamn stupid and hard-headed to say that.
Until he wrote his book 15 years later.
Until he wrote his book, and he could sell some sell more autographs.
Right.
And the guy, I would see him. It was a shopping thing right by Caesar's Palace. And it's a guy with 4,100 hits signing autographs for fat guys in what are you doing, Pete? You should be at every Reds game. People adore you. You could be everything you want to. Just say, you know what? I did. I bet on baseball. And, of course, the excuse was I never against my team. And he said, well, the bookie knew you didn't bet. It didn't matter. Yeah, and the rule was so clear, so unambiguous in every club room. They pounded it home. They were going to let him go anyway.
He got what he deserved. You know, Mark Shields and I, turning into Kembe, were season tickets holder at Georgetown. I remember back over 30 years ago, we're so excited Alonzo Mourning was going to become the next Patrick Ewing. He was. And then suddenly you see this 7'2" kid from Africa. You think, who the hell is that? He was kind of awkward, ungainly. He came to Georgetown to study medicine, and the great John Thompson turned him into a Hall of Fame basketball player, Dikembe Mutombo. He was a great player, was even better citizen, the NBA global ambassadors. He built hospitals and medical facilities in poor African countries and had such – the few times I was around him, had such a contagious laughter and speech. He died much too young, brain cancer at 58, but Dikembe Mutombo made a real mark in America.
He did. And you make a point, and I think it's something NBA should consider. But also, again, you should have native-born NBA players play foreign-born NBA players.
Right.
And that guy, when he came aboard, no one would have even thought that would be anything close to a fair match.
Yeah.
Now, I bet you the foreign-born NBA players might be a slight favorite. And they surely wouldn't be much of an underdog. Okay. And he was one of the real pioneers in making the NBA I don't know, safe space, open or enthusiastic about foreign-born basketball players. And it's become a really global sport, probably in a way that even football and baseball are, you know, baseball kind of global in Japan and Korea, maybe, is, you know, Caribbean, Mexico, but not like the NBA. And the NBA should really name something big after him, because he was a great player on the court, but his influence on the game of professional basketball is got to be one of the top five of all time.
And his good works were, in some ways, even more impressive than his great basketball skills. I will never forget going to those games with my friend Mark and watching Alonzo Mourning and Dikembe there. You didn't want to drive it and try a layup then, but he was great. James, give me one just 15, 20 seconds of personal privilege here, because a dear friend, Joel Fleischman, died age 90. Joel was part of that Terry Sanford group in the 60s that changed the face of North Carolina. He launched the Sanford Public Policy School at Duke. Then he was a major philanthropist, gave away lots of money, a great supporter of public service. And on the side, he was Vanity Fair's wine critic. Of all those great achievements, one I think that stands out almost as much as any of them, he was an incredibly close friend and close advisor to my wife, Judy Woodruff. He was a Renaissance man who made a difference. Joel Fleischman, rest in peace.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
James, our guest, is arguably the greatest tennis player of all times. Martina Navratilova, she won 59 major championships, her first at age 18, her last at age 50. Martina, we are in awe of not only your career, but what you've done since then and your social and political activism. But the first question, let me ask you this. If James and I were to play doubles against you and Chrissy Everett, one set, would we have a chance to win 1 point?
1 point? No. Yeah, 1 point, that can always happen. I mean, we could double fall.
That's but, it. That would be, we'd be praying for a double fall.
I thought you were playing for a games or sets. So a point is possible. Anyhow, nice to see you guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
And by the way, I was 49 and 11 months when I won my last.
Oh, you didn't make it to 50? Okay. I stand corrected.
I did not. That was a month later. Yeah, I got my AARP card in the mail the next month.
49 and 11 months are pretty darn good. You're politically progressive, a passionate champion of gender equality and in civil society of trans rights. But you oppose allowing men to participate in women's sports. You said men don't belong in women's sports, women's bathrooms, or locker rooms. That annoyed some critics that you, as a longtime liberal and one of the first openly gay athletes, they say you've turned right. I don't think that's true. But how do you answer the identity left on that issue?
Well, identity is one thing, but identity does not apply to sports. Sex category applies to sports. Male bodies are different from female bodies. And yes, I mean, I came out at 81 when it was definitely not the thing to do. You know, I've been out way before any kind of LGB community was organized, LGBT community. And now people say I turned right. I did not. I've stayed as left as I possibly can be without going into socialism, communism, all for civil rights for everybody, equal rights for everybody. But when it comes to sports, we have categories. We have rules for a reason. And male bodies, again, are different. And there's no way to take away the advantage that a male has, no matter how they identify. So by all means, everyday life, acceptance in every which way. But when it comes to female sex-based spaces, which includes sports, then I think we need to put a line there and say, you know, we just really need this space to be female. And that's the end
of that. Well, that context is important because you are talking just about sports. And on the question of transgender rights, I think it's accurate to say that you say that's an issue for parents, families, not politicians.
I mean, it's akin to women's right to choose what she does with her body. I think parents should have a say and certainly knowledge of what their kids are doing, especially when it can be a life-altering situation, when they start taking puberty blockers, or worse yet, have irreversible surgeries. So, of course, parents should know about all of that. And, you know, most kids, when they have gender dysphoria, which is what most of this stuff is, they grow out of it. And quite often, these kids are just gay kids. They're lesbians and gay boys that think they need to be women to be accepted as gay men. It just gets crazy. And I think we need to let kids be kids and see where it takes them. If you still want that surgery and those hormones when you're an adult, when your brain is fully formed, by all means, go for it. But in the meantime, I think parents need to know what's going on with their kids, just like you would want to know if they're drinking too much or smoking who knows what, or, you know, taking any kind of drugs.
Yeah. You're a Kamala Harris supporter. You've sharply criticized not only Trump, but some of the MAGA cheerleaders like Megyn Kelly. How do you view, you've been very active politically and knowledgeable. How do you view the consequences of a Donald Trump election?
It truly scares me. The man will not, this would be the last election. He will not leave the office. He is enamored with dictators. He's enamored with people that don't have to leave, you know, that have a lifetime appointment to the presidency or the prime minister or whatever you want to call him. He would totally abolish the Constitution. He's already said about canceling the Constitution. And now he will have people that will do all his bidding. And the guardrails will not hold. They will not hold. Look at the Supreme Court. I mean, the guy is dangerous. He's a wannabe, I don't want to say fascist, but he's got all those tendencies of controlling people. And I think it would just be a disaster. I'm not a hyperbolic person at all. I do not exaggerate. I really state facts as they are. And he scares the hell out of me.
James.
So, you know, greatest female tennis player in history, I say so. Somebody might argue that. That's not the argument I have. You are the most impactful female athlete in history. Mm. I mean, and you have to look, and I'm just look at last April. The women's basketball tournament had the same rating as the men's basketball tournament. That is in large part because of you. But, I mean, you changed, and I'm not that knowledgeable tennis player, but I called, and people that know tennis said, you literally changed the way they played women's tennis.
Thank you. There were Serena Valliers, Billie Jean King, Margaret Court, Virginia Wade, Ivan Goligon. They were coming to the net. And guys, too, but I took it to another level with fitness, with diet, with doing everything that I possibly could to be the best athlete I could be, therefore the best tennis player. And I was, quite frankly, stronger and better than they were. So I played tennis the way I thought it should be played, male or female, I don't care. And yes, I'm proud of that. And I think also when it came to women athletes, I think I made women feel that they don't have to apologize for being great athletes, for having muscles, for being strong, for being powerful, for being competitive. You know, when you say about Rafa Nadal, he's so competitive. It's a positive. But so many times I've had people say, oh, you're so competitive. Why? I'm like, really? You know, because I'm a woman, I'm not supposed to be competitive. Whoever goes on the court saying, oh, I want to lose today. Of course I'm competitive. I worked my ass off to get to where I am. So, yeah, I want to win. So I think I just took it to another level for women to kind of aspire to.
So everybody remembers that you and Chris Everett Lloyd played a lot of tennis against each other. Yeah. And kind of struck me as, you know, different athletes are admirable, but y'all have become very good friends post-tennis career. How did that come about? You know, you would think, you know, maybe there was some kind of, I don't know, competitiveness, jealous, I don't, whatever it is, but I think it's a beautiful relationship. And I think it says a lot about women's sports and the relationships that you make in it.
Well, it is, you know, the press try to pit us against each other. So, oh, Chris said this or Martina said that. And we made a pact with each other that we would only talk to each other and not respond to what the press said, because they were just trying to make us go at it like, you know, cats fight. And, you know, there's a net in between us, so that helps. You just play the ball that the opponent hits, so you don't take it personally. And we were still competitive, but we became friends, I think, during our career, but particularly after, once we were not having to play against each other, it became easier. And then, of course, we've gone through some horrible stuff with cancer together at the same time and supported each other. And in fact, we're doing a documentary now that should be out next year about our friendship and relationship and rivalry. So that's all cool.
Yeah. I can't wait to see that. So, right back to Al, but you grew up, you were born and spent time in a communist country that obviously didn't have freedoms. How did that affect you? And did that make you more willing to come out and be a more aggressive athlete, to come out on behalf of rights of sexual minorities or whatever? Did that sort of help form you and give you courage?
You know, growing up in a communist country, your options are very limited. What job you can go into, what school you can go into, where you can go. You cannot really travel outside. And when I made that big step to defect, to leave my country, which was a one-way ticket, I did not see my family for 4 years, my mom for 4 years, my dad for 5 years, and my sister left them behind, couldn't go back. Not speaking out was just, now I'm free. I'm not going to be punished if I say something against the government. They're not going to throw me in jail or send me to Siberia. So, of course, I felt this freedom and strength from that no matter what I did, no matter what I said, well, that was not criminal, obviously, no matter what I did or said, I could still play tennis and I could speak out and I would not be punished for it. So I wasn't going to be quiet. And nowadays I get stuff, you know, on Twitter or people saying, oh, shut the fuck up, whatever. You know, what do you know about this? You just play tennis. I'm like, well, first of all, I'm free. Number one, I'm defected. So yes, I can keep speaking out and I'm not going to, I never let people shut me up, so I'm certainly not going to start now. So I think it did give me the strength to come out and be myself, because, you know, the worst was behind me. The worst was leaving my country and leaving my family behind. After that, everything was piece of cake, really.
Thanks, Albert.
I believe that you are a dual citizen now of the United States and the Czech Republic, and you do go back to your native country some. Yep. What are you, from the vantage point of the Czech Republic, what are the stakes and concerns with the war in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, Czech, you know, there was a cartoon way back that I remember seeing, a Czech cartoon, and the man says, we are in the heart of Europe. But I ask you, why? Why? We're always stuck in the middle of all these fights. And whether it's political or wars and conflicts, and Czechs just want to get along. They, you know, we're very industrious people. We just want to be left alone and to our own devices and not get stuck in these conflicts. But geographically, we have no choice. So, of course, it's some people just want the war to be over, but most are in support of Ukraine. And you know, we were under the thumb of Soviet Union for 50 years, almost. 40 good years. So we don't want to go back there under any kind of a totalitarian regime. So, of course, Czechs support Ukrainians in their fight for democracy.
I read, I believe, that you and your wife have adopted twin boys.
We did? Two boys.
Two boys.
They're not twins. They're a year apart.
Do they have tennis rackets yet?
Not yet. I think I'm going to take the three-year-old out. He wants to play. Yeah, you know, of course, I watch tennis on TV. Tennis. So we drop by some tennis courts. So I think it's too hot in Miami right now, but there's no global warming, but it's just hot.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take him. Hopefully next week we'll get out there and play some. Yeah. So I have not put a racket in his hands yet, but he has seen me He has seen photos, but he's been watching tennis.
He's got a pretty good model. They both do. Let me just stay on tennis for a final question before I turn it back to James. When you started a half century ago, I think it's fair to say the United States was basically the dominant force in both men's and women's tennis. There were other stars, you know, like you, like the Australians. But now most of the top men, and to a slightly lesser extent, most of the top women are not Americans. Is that because the rest of the world caught up, or do we do an inadequate job of developing players?
No, I think, well, two things. The rest of the world caught up, have had the opportunities. And maybe for some places, that's the only opportunity they have to get out or to do something. And they're more motivated, I think. Americans are a bit soft because we have it easy. There's no doubt the life is easier here than anywhere else in the world, other than maybe, I don't know, Holland. But it's just different, right?
Yeah.
And the opportunities in Europe are much greater for the club tennis, what players can go. It's not an expensive sport like it is here. And mostly it's just become more international and the rest of the world caught up. That's the thing. It's not that we're better athletes in Europe than here, obviously. But best athletes here, they go more for football, baseball, basketball, hockey. Women, they like to play basketball, volleyball, which is fantastic, but we don't necessarily get the best athletes. But it's just become much more competitive worldwide, and that's a great thing. There's a lot more names that you can't pronounce these days than there used to be when I first came up.
Yeah, well, I think women's tennis is more interesting to watch, certainly on television, than men's tennis. But, you know, that goes back to you. James Carville?
Before I go, two fun things I want to ask you about. I'm sure you crossed paths with now deceased my old friend Milos Forman, the great director, Czech director.
I have. It's funny you should mention it. I just was had this honorary award given to me in the Czech embassy last week in New York, and Martina Forman, Milos's widow, had given that award to me. I met Milos 40 years ago when I was playing at the U.S. Open. And we became friends and hung out. And he was just such a character, such a great guy. And I was so sad he passed away. I didn't know he was sick.
He cast me in one of his movies, and we just had a great time hanging out.
Yeah.
Together. So before I let you go, there are two cities that I've never been to that I'm going to no matter what. One is Milan, and the other one is Prague. So when I go to Prague, can you help me with my arrangements, maybe a restaurant reservation here or there, or, you know, a good guy?
This is called a shakedown, Martina.
Yeah,
this
is a shakedown. I will find out for you, James, where to go, because when I go home, we live about 20 miles outside Prague, and my sister cooks, so I don't go to restaurants because she's an amazing cook. But I will go to bat for you and find out where you should go. You cannot go wrong, really. And
I don't think.
You'd got to go.
I've heard so many wonderful things about it.
It's fantastic. I would recommend October is the best month. It's not cold yet, and most of the tourists are gone, so you can walk around and really absorb it. You can walk everywhere, and it's a beautiful, beautiful city. I didn't appreciate it when I lived there, when I was born there and when I spent a lot of time there, but it's just spectacular, so you got to go.
Sometimes I have some pretty good beer there, too. I might get a little Pilsner.
Beer is the best. The beer is
it
the
is
best.
A beautiful, beautiful city. When my wife and I went there some years ago, we had a great tour recommender, Madeline Albright, who was, along with Martina, one of the great natives of then Czechoslovakia. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been
Thank you, Angel. Love you.
Thanks, guys. Go Kamala. I have my Kamala hat.
Send us pictures of that 3-year-old when he picks up the tennis racket.
Eventually, yeah. I got my Kamala hat on, but it doesn't look so good on me anymore because my hair is so short. But anyhow, go Harris and Waltz. I'm all in.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You know, now for my outrage, James has done his. Donald Trump likes to hurt people. He really does. He once mockingly imitated a reporter who had physical disabilities. So last weekend, he viciously attacked his opponent, Kamala Harris, not for her tax policies or her foreign policies, but he said she was mentally, quote, mentally disabled, that she was born that way. You know, of course, it's a lie, but he does that all the time. The American Association of People with Disabilities said Trump's language reflects, quote, his hateful bias against people with disabilities. That's no surprise. Spewing hate and trying to hurt people is what Trump is all about. I'm more interested in the reaction, which I haven't heard any, of one of his supporters. No American family has been more supportive of helping those with mental health issues than the Kennedys. We know that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. sold his political values and integrity in embracing Trump. If he remains silent on this slur, too, we'll know that he sold his whole soul.
Good Bobby Kennedy. Jesus Christ. He lied to protect his cousin who beat a woman to get death with a golf club. All right? I agree. This whole fascination with Bobby Kennedy, somebody's going to have to explain it to me. All right, I'm sorry. His dad was a pioneer and groundbreaking, courageous guy who, you know, was tragically assassinated on the day I got out of the Marine Corps. I'll never forget that. But America just needs to give up its Bobby Kennedy habit. He's just a pathetic, crazy, worm-addled brain, no good guy that protected a murderer.
Yeah, he really is. And he's... You know, rarely has a candidate so discredited himself. He didn't start on a very high level, and he's ended up on an even lower level.
Yeah, the guy started at like 17, and right. He's now down to 0.7 of a percentage point. And the public has figured him out way, way ahead of anybody else. I promise you, they know exactly who this guy is.
Now for our listener questions. As always, they're a highlight of this show. Ed James in Raleigh, North Carolina, talk about a key battleground place, says, for every migrant crime ad run against Kamala, why isn't there a corresponding ad highlighting Trump's pardon recipients re-criming themselves back into court? Thank you, Mr. Manafort.
It's a very good question, a good observation. Right now, I'm a one-trick pony. Get on J.D. Vance for remotely claiming that Trump had anything to do with saving Obamacare. He's a criminal. We all know he's a criminal. But make this Obamacare, this healthcare thing, front and center. Do it now. Please do it now. Like, in the next hour, have the vice president go out and bring this up. It's a great issue.
Eric in Camarillo, California, says, if Josh Shapiro had been the Democrat nominee for vice president, Trump and Vance would have reversed course on Israel and leaned into anti-Semitism and fake claims of Shapiro being in the pocket of Israel. What do you think? I think they would have done anything. I mean, they don't, you know, Trump doesn't believe in a thing. He's a bigot. So if that was advantageous, he would have done that. I said at the time I would have picked Shapiro. I think he would have been a stronger candidate, but I think Tim Walz is doing just fine.
I agree with every word you said.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jake in Whidbey Island, Washington, the home of my dear friends Bob and Sue Mary. What a fabulous place Whidbey Island is, Jake. And this is for you, James. Do you feel we have a failure of imagination on what Trump and his shady crew are doing to move the needle? For example, while we're buying online ads, they're buying influences and opening Spanish language news stations. Are we bringing an ad? He says, are we bringing an ad to a propaganda war?
Of course they would do every slimy, unprincipled, illegal, cheap, dirty thing that they could do. We can fully expect that. And I'm sure that they're doing, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in Spanish language radio that we don't know about. And, you know, to the extent that they can do stuff, we should be monitoring this stuff day and night. And by the way, a lot of the thousands of people that view this podcast that are very fluent in Spanish. Don't wait on orders from headquarters. Take it on yourself to look at this stuff. Try to inform yourself what they're doing, because I'm going to show you they're doing sleazy, rotten, lying crap, because that's what they are. They're sleazy, rotten, lying people. And that's what they do. I think one of the things that we learned today from our friend Ben Wickler, they're doing a lot of this stuff, but they're not doing fundamental bargaining and tackling in terms of getting their vote out. And we are doing that. And boy, that might be a key percentage point, a half a percent in a lot of different states. So let's double down on that too.
Absolutely. Brett in Los Gatos, California, says it seems that Harris-Waltz need to win three battles: the election shenanigans contesting the results if Trump loses, and the civil unrest if Trump loses. The shenanigan games, which he always does. Is the Biden administration ready for the second and third battles? I think the answer to that is yes. They are going. They have filed more lawsuits now. The one thing the Trump people learned is that when you're going to try to cheat, you cheat before the election. You don't just wait till afterwards. But the Biden team, or excuse me, the Harris team is more than prepared. They have hundreds of great lawyers all around the country ready for these challenges that are going to come up. It's very important that the Democrats win the House, too, because you know Mike Johnson would do whatever Trump tells him to do. So I think that's fair. And, a friend of mine said, I don't think he means it literally, but metaphorically, one advantage the Democrats have this time they didn't have last time is that as he put it, we have the guns. They control, Biden controls the National Guard. And I don't think it'll come to that. But if it does, I think actually they're in a better position than was the case 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's – I don't mean this in a condescending way, but President Biden should be prepared and preparing his administration for everything else. Vice President Harris has one mission, and that is to win on Election Day and the early vote and everything leading up to Election Day. So I think there should be – it's important. There should be a division of labor. She should not, in her campaign, should not spend one second of time on what's going to happen after the election. They need to concentrate on the election. That's not to say it's not important, not to say there shouldn't be people who work in administration who are responsible for election integrity to be watching this. That's not to say there shouldn't be lawyers preparing for this, but they got to look at everything between now and Election Day and not be distracted by anything.
Yeah, I agree. Richard in New York City, James, wants to know, after the severe hurricane in the South, should Kamala Harris hit the climate change issue harder, particularly in those states?
No. I mean, first of all, completely agree with you. Completely, and I don't think there's a person in the world that doesn't think that this event that happened, particularly in Western Carolina, North Carolina, was not fueled by climate. But you got a limited amount of time. You can talk about 31 felony convictions. You can talk about the sleaziness. You can talk about climate change. You can talk about all of that. Just go do the goddamn press conference on J.D. Vance saying that Trump saved Obamacare. It is what you choose not to do is critical. All legit. All very legit. And, hopefully people will wake up and say, Jesus, look at what happened. I mean, the amount of water, and it's just something I know something about. It was 14 inches of rain. You can't imagine how much water that is in a place that understandably did not have anything remotely like the infrastructure to deal with this, because no one would have, that would not have been in a 1,000-year plan for drainage.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of 1,000-year events that are coming soon to a neighborhood near you, I promise you. And this was, this is the second most destructive storm in the last 50 years other than Katrina. And it happened where you never, ever, if you ever thought you were safe from climate change, it would be Western North Carolina. It's 70 degrees in August there, all right? You moved there. There's a lot of people from the Gulf Coast, a lot of people from Louisiana have places in Western North Carolina. It was considered to be a refuge from people being affected by climate change. By the way, Phoenix is going to have 132 straight days of 100 and above. The previous record was 72. I think they're trying. I think somebody's trying to tell us something.
Yeah. Everybody ought to read George Packer's piece on Phoenix in the Atlantic a couple months ago. We have a question from John in Chicago. I think he's an old friend. He said, if Kamala Harris gets elected president and the Republicans gain control of the Senate, will she be able to get any of her cabinet nominees approved? And will she end up keeping some of President Biden's cabinet? It'll be a challenge. She's not going to be able to name anybody from the left wing of the party, because Republicans will try to stymie her from day one, because that's what they do. There are a couple Republicans who may go along, like Lisa Murkowski. But you have to bring it up for a vote. So if they control the Senate, they control the calendar. I think she ought to keep, if she's elected, some of the Biden cabinet members. Bill Burns, the CIA director, is as good as it gets. And whether it's Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, whatever have you, they ought to keep him. And there's some others. But look, if they win this Senate from day one, the Republicans' mission will be to try to destroy the Harris presidency. That's just a reality.
Well, maybe the greatest cabinet secretary this century is the secretary is Tom Vilsack. But they're probably too old now. The book probably doesn't want to do it. But yeah, there's plenty of capable people in the Biden administration that she can hold over. And you're exactly right about the Senate. It's going to be a march. They usually, will eventually confirm people that happened before, but it's going to be a giant pain in the ass. It's going to be a giant use of resources that you could use in other places. And I'm just not convinced we're going to lose the Senate yet. I'm more open to the idea that we're going to hold on another people.
Yeah. I mean, a month ago, people laughed if you mentioned the possibility even of winning Texas. And I saw the Cook Political Report has just moved it from likely Republican to lean Republican. That's a good direction. Alexander from across the pond in Rotterdam, Netherlands, James, says, what do you make of Senator Manchin refusing to endorse Harris? What will his legacy look like?
I don't think it matters that much. I mean, Dick Cheney, you got everything from Dick Cheney to AOC. I like Senator Manchin. He said that the filibuster is fundamentally democracy, which, I'm sorry, Senator Manchin is
the Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if before this is over that he endorses the vice president. I don't know that. I know that he is pretty fervently pro-choice. And hopefully Senator Manchin will think about the totality of it all and, would like to have his voice. I think he's an important voice. And we shouldn't give up on the idea that he might eventually change his mind. Because I don't think he's right about it.
Okay. Keep those letters coming in, emails coming in to Politicon. They're great questions. If we didn't get to them this week, we'll try next week. But thank you. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Remember to get your tickets for Politics War Room Tour. James and I are bringing the podcast to you live on stage at Boston Schubert Theater on November 2nd. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Glean, 3-Day Blinds, and Beam, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.